Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. You know, many people who are atheists call themselves humanists. Rather than believe in a supernatural God, they believe that people, human beings, have the ultimate say about our own fate and the responsibility to act morally without the fear or the love of an invisible higher power, humanism. My next guest, Robert Zubrin, is an engineer, an inventor of spaceflight technology products, and a conservative thinker critical of what he calls anti-humanism, people who don't like people, or at least think we are a scourge on the earth. Mostly he sees anti-humanism behind the environmental movement. His new book is called Merchants of Despair. Mr. Zubrin, welcome to WNYC.
Thanks for inviting me.
Can you tell us a little about yourself first? You've got an unusual combination of activities with your company, your space products company, Pioneer Astronautics. You're founder of the Mars Society, and you're a fellow with the Center for Security Policy. What brings all those together?
Well, the first, I'm a person who believes in technological progress and the advancement of the scientific and human frontier. And that's what brings together Mars and space technology and so forth. And Center for Security Policy, well, I'm a patriot. I think America should be defended.
You see anti-humanism, to use your phrase, masquerading as environmentalism. Can you further define what you mean by anti-humanism?
Yeah, sure. It's the belief that human beings are basically destroyers, they're basically vermin, and that they're out of control, and so they've got to be put under control, and so somebody's got to be put in control. And so ultimately, it's an argument for tyranny. And it's a very interesting thing, because this general argument has sometimes taken on right-wing coloration, sometimes left-wing coloration. The categories of left and right don't properly describe it. But it's always convenient for those seeking to enhance their power.
Well, in your opinion, is there a real environmentalism that you think is worthwhile and then a kind captured by an anti-humanist impulse?
Sure. And I distinguish them in the book. Okay, there's practical environmentalism, which is, look, we don't want people dumping industrial waste into the reservoir, and so we should have a regulation that stops people from dumping industrial waste into the reservoir. And so this is simply a practical arrangement to make life better for people. Okay, that's a very good thing, and I support that. On the other hand, there's ideological environmentalism or anti-humanism, which basically uses instances of human damage to the environment, whether real or imagined, to essentially make a case against humanity. So let's take this current example of global warming. You know, in the 1970s, there was a global cooling trend going on, and a number of the older generation of the current global warmists said, look, there's global cooling. It's being caused by industry, which is being driven by population growth and economic growth, and we gotta put those under control, or we're gonna have a new ice age. Then in the 80s, it started to warm, and many of the same people said, "Look, there's global warming. It's being driven by industry, which is being driven by population growth and economic growth. So we gotta put those under control in order to stop a new hot age." And you know, the problem can be the exact opposite, but the solution is always the same: more control.
But this debate has been. I don't want to linger on this, but I didn't get the impression from your book that you're an out-and-out global warming denier, but those few people who for a few minutes said the Earth seemed to potentially be cooling, that doesn't negate the 97% of climate scientists who are not there because they have an ideological axe to grind, but because they're scientists and have come to this rough consensus on the trajectory of Earth warming, correct? Just very briefly?
Very briefly, I don't know if 97% is true, but it's true, certainly true that a lot of scientists, including me, think that there is a warming trend right now. But that's entirely different from saying we need to have central controls to ration the use of fire.
to ration the use of fire. In other words, controlling energy sources. But is
that's right. I mean, in other words, those are two completely different issues. The question of whether you think a hurricane is coming is different than whether you think we should have human sacrifices to stop hurricanes from coming.
Well,
those are two very different questions.
That's right. What do you do about a threat? And my impression of your book is that you think global warming is real, but that it's overstated as a threat. And that you
think the
fear-mongering, as you see it, over global warming threatens more people than doing nothing about it, basically, right? You see
I'm saying we're a lot more threatened by people who want to institute all kinds of controls on human society, including regressive carbon taxes, to stop global warming than we are threatened by global warming. In fact, the climate is always changing. We've had warming in the past. We've had cooling in the past. In general, in fact, warming trends have been better times than cooling trends. And as far as carbon emissions are concerned, I mean, carbon is increasing in the atmosphere. Is this good or bad? Well, we have photographs taken from orbit since 1958, and they show that since 1958, the rate of plant growth on Earth has accelerated by 14%. And this is unquestionably due to the enrichment of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, because you can repeat this in terrariums. If you enrich CO2, plants will grow faster for very understandable reasons. If CO2 were disappearing from the atmosphere, that would be a cause for alarm. But here we're enhancing the CO2 content of the atmosphere, and yet the prosecution calls for us to be condemned on that basis.
And yet you say global warming threatens, I'm sorry, that fear-mongering over global warming, as you see it, threatens millions of lives in the developing world. And yet scientists tend to see the global warming as a gigantic threat to the developing world for a number of reasons.
You don't have your 97% for that. Because the idea that, I mean, what evidence is there that the current temperature is the best one? There's none. There is zero evidence to support that.
Well, here are some of the arguments that I'm familiar with. As the world gets hotter, the Sahara Desert is expanding, making it harder to grow food crops in Africa. Also, the more impoverished countries tend to be in the warmest climates, where sea level rise will be the biggest threat to large coastal populations compared to elsewhere in the world. Also, developing nations use much less carbon-producing energy sources than countries like the U.S., so we are imposing this on them. How much of all that do you disagree with?
Pretty much all of it. The global warming, okay, first of all, carbon dioxide accelerates plant growth, which benefits everyone on Earth as well as the natural biosphere. Literally one out of
not if it's increasing desertification. And
No. Okay, let's take these things one at a time, okay? Carbon dioxide in itself is beneficial. Number two, global warming increases net rainfall worldwide. So while some deserts are growing, others are shrinking. These things are always changing. On balance, global warming increases worldwide rainfall. Also, global warming lengthens the growing season. These are all good things. If the opposite was happening, if carbon dioxide was disappearing from the atmosphere, if the world was getting colder, if rainfall was decreasing, boy, that would be a disaster scenario. Okay, but so what you have here is a situation where you've got a prosecution which is looking for any grounds whatsoever to portray the human race as being criminal. Okay, it's like somebody who says someone is a criminal because they burst into your house and rescued your child from a fire without your permission. They are trespassing. Here, you know, in other words, the issue here is that what we've got are people who are looking for any excuse to portray the human race as being vermin who need to be under control.
Well,
this is dangerous.
This point, and there, you know, we'll leave the rest of the scientific debate over the extent of global warming, the effects of global warming, the effects of solutions to global warming, for ongoing conversations. But why frame disputes over science with the disparaging label of anti-humanism rather than a scientific disagreement among you and other people who disagree with you of goodwill? You and Al Gore, who you mentioned in the book, might disagree over the projected impacts of global warming and current energy sources, but aren't you both humanists in the sense of being interested in the fate of humanity? Why fight with this disparaging label rather than
just
fight over?
Let me,
What's best?
Can I answer your question?
Yes.
Okay, because these people, in addition to, I mean, this carbon thing, I mean, these people say the world is overpopulated, and as a result, they have pushed policies where U.S. foreign aid has been linked to forced sterilization programs in countries like India, Indonesia, Peru.
But that's a hysterical claim. They are not.
No, that's not a hysterical claim at
nobody
all.
Nobody in the U.S. government supports
No. This is true.
Keyword forced sterilization.
No, that's absolutely false. Famine aid was denied to India unless they implemented population control, and they were given quotas, and Indira Gandhi rounded up millions of women and put them in camps and forcibly sterilized them. In Peru, Fujimori did it, and he and his government and many of those people were tried for genocide.
But you're going all the way. If you're going to that extreme to make the case,
no, this is not extreme. This is true.
But let's
pick up a copy of the Pick up a copy of the Population Bomb by Paul Ehrlich, and he says explicitly that famine aid should be denied to India unless they implement population control. And the Johnson administration acceded to that, and this was done. This is a massive crime that was done, and it was incited by the population control lobby.
But let's say even
if this cannot be denied.
Even if that was true.
It is true.
That doesn't necessarily mean that overpopulation is not a problem. I don't know if you saw the article in the New York Times yesterday about Nigeria as an example of a number of sub-Saharan African countries where women are still bearing, on average, 5 children or more. And the point was that with that much population growth in small economy countries, the possibility of economic growth at any historically expectable level will not be nearly enough to provide for all the hungry new mouths.
Well, no, actually, that's false. Look, as world population has gone up, standard of livings have gone up. The densest populated country in the world is Holland, which has one of the highest standard of livings. The most undensely populated continent is Africa, which has the lowest standard of living. Okay, it is simply untrue that population growth, that human well-being is inversely proportional to human numbers. That's a false theory. Okay, it was false when Malthus said it. It was false when Ehrlich said it in 1968. Okay, he said in 1968, world population is going to double by the year 2000. He was close to being right about that. And he said, and therefore, there are going to be mass starvation all over the world because of this. And therefore, we have to let India go down the drain. Well, he was dead wrong on that. People are much better off on the whole worldwide now than they were in 1968, just as they were much better off in 1968 than they were in 1930, when the world population was half of what it was in 1968.
And people would disagree on the reasons for that. But we are out of time, so we leave it there with Robert Zubrin, author of the new book, Merchants of Despair. Thank you very much for having the conversation.
Thanks. We got a website at merchantsofdespair.com.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up, more technological futures. This time, John Long, professor of both biology and robotics, on what robot science can teach us about human life and the implication for people when robots can reproduce. Stay with us.